An anonymous individual close to the Cameron Hooker trial said, "People like to believe in an Einstein or a Beethoven. Geniuses. But they hate to believe in their opposites. A genius is a mutant, something unnatural. But just as some people are born with extra intelligence, others are born without much intelligence or without fingers or limbs or consciences. The human body is phenomenally complex with trillions of cells and trillions of things that can go wrong. Cameron Hooker is a fluke, an accident of internal wiring. His instincts are simply the opposite of yours and mine." And in this episode, we're going to find out whether Cameron paid for his sins. I'm Marina. With me, I have my best friend, Laura, and this is Grimm.
Was a very eloquent and haunting quote. However, one question is consciences. I have never heard that pluralized.
Conscience.
Yeah,
conscience. Well, the one. It's fingers or limbs or consciences. Multiple people.
It with yeah.
Multiple people.
Consciences.
Conscienci. Now that I'm saying it out loud, it's sounds
not a real
wrong.
Word. It's so not if a real it's word not, anymore.
Well, you know what? I quoted it and it was a wrong word quoted. So sick. It wasn't my word.
Sick. Okay.
Brackets, sick.
Brackets,
that bitch.
Sick.
Okay. Thanks for coming back for part three of this case, the finale. And by the way, it was almost four parts, but I reined that shit in. Before we get started, I have a very important update. Like, it's going to blow your goddamn mind.
I don't even know what.
There are 12,000 species of moss.
I'm not sure what the number I thought. I forgot completely that we had that discussion.
I remembered because I pushed it off from episode one onto two and then two onto three.
Now you're at the end of the line.
So you're welcome. 12,000 species of moss. So maybe people are really into collecting various species and that's.
Or they're cross-pollinating, and that's why there's 12,000.
Yeah.
Because they keep creating more.
Could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you're not just joining us, because you'll be like, well, this is the worst podcast I've ever heard. Goodbye. So for part three, again, I relied almost exclusively on the book The Perfect Victim by Christine McGuire and Carla Norton. Christine McGuire is the prosecutor in this case. Mm-hmm. If you have liked my coverage of this case, you will love the book, so go read it. And then I read a few articles for the final update. I needed more recent information that happened after the book. Before we get started, we have a bunch of Patreon Woo-hoo! Shout-outs this week.
My favorite.
First up, Lila M.
Woo! Lila, we love you.
Thank you. Ciara A.
Ciara, woo! We love you.
Thank you. Anna.
Woo!
Or Anna.
Well, yeah.
Elsa, either. Anna. Anna. We love you. Thank you. Woo! Emily J.
Emily. Woo! Emily, thank you.
We love you. Thank you. Cam W.
Cam, thank you.
Thank you, Cam. Woo. Canyon F.
Woo, Canyon.
Woo, Canyon. Woo. We love you.
Are you deep?
I don't know. She just like chest bumped when she said that.
I don't know. I just was thinking Canyon was cool, and then was Canyon a nickname, or is that?
And it's Canyon, you know? With a K.
Oh,
so it probably is Canyon. Cool.
Yeah, that is a real name.
Just don't chest bump the names. It's
sorry,
weird.
I like it. I like it.
Devin I. Woo!
Devin, woo!
Thank you, Devin. Woo! We love you. Holly B.
Holly. Woo-hoo! Holly Berry? Question mark?
I doubt it. Maybe. But yay, we love you. Woo! Thank you so much, Holly Berry. No, it's Halle Berry.
Fuck, you're right. Man.
Okay. And finally, we have the notorious BAG.
Woohoo!
BAG, we love you.
Woo! Badass gremlin.
And it may be Betty the giraffe?
Maybe.
Okay.
Betty a giraffe.
Ba G. We love you. Thank you so much.
It's a soft G.
Hey.
Ba.
Oh, God. Guys, so sorry. We're off the rails tonight.
Oh, yeah.
We love you so much. Thank you so much for your love and support. As always, you guys are the best. Okay. So when we left off, there was no tea in that. When we left off, Janice Hooker had just confessed to all of the sins of the Hooker household to her pastor, who, with her permission, called the police. The police dispatched Detective Al Shamblin to take Janice's statement. Janice told the detective how Cameron kidnapped Colleen and enslaved her for 7 years. But Janice had another revelation for the police. She confessed to Detective Shamblin that Colleen was not the only victim of Cameron's depraved fantasies. She said that in late January 1976, Cameron and Janice had picked up a young girl named Marliz Spanicky in Chico, California, and he murdered her. You forgot about this from the last episode. It's like living it all over again. Things are more fun when you have the memory of a goldfish.
Hashtag kids.
Yeah. Hashtag mom brain.
Yep.
Detective Shamblin took the information back to police headquarters. His interest obviously peaked. With such a sensational storyline from Janice, the police must have thought they were dealing with a criminal maniac. They ran a background check and Cameron came back squeaky clean.
Of course.
No priors at all.
Yep.
Weird.
Mm-hmm.
Detective Shamblin's superior, Lieutenant Brown, called the Chico Police Department to determine if he could corroborate any of the information from Janice. Chico police confirmed that there was an 18-year-old girl by the name of Marie Elizabeth Spanicky, who was nicknamed Marliz, who had disappeared on January 31st, 1976.
Oh.
Her case had previously gone cold and was long forgotten on a shelf until Janice resurrected it.
Wow.
The police knew immediately that they had nothing to go on but Janice, so they headed straight to the district attorney's office to seek immunity for her cooperation, to which the DA agreed.
Good.
The police returned to Janice with her get-out-of-jail-free card, looking for Janice to fill in the details, and she was prepared to tell them what she knew. Late in January 1976, by the way, this is like the inception of cases. This is like a case within a case.
That's like the Murdoch one, isn't it?
Murdoch. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the boat case that, and
yeah,
then the
boat case. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Bodie McBoatface.
Yeah. The boat case.
Late in January 1976, Janice and Cameron Hooker were driving that blue Dodge Colt around Chico, California, which is about 40 minutes away from Red Bluff. Marie Elizabeth Spanicky was walking alone when Cameron spotted her and offered her a ride. Marie agreed and got in the back seat. She introduced herself as Marliz and asked them to drop her off at her apartment. Cameron brought her to her destination and Janice got out of the car to let Marliz exit. But when Marliz went to get out, Cameron grabbed her by her hair and pulled her back in.
Ugh.
He jammed her head between the car seats and drove off. Although he struggled to do so, Cameron was able to restrain her. He drove her to a dirt road, tied her up, and then put the head box on her.
Literally just stuff of complete nightmares.
Mm-hmm. And very similar to something we've heard before.
Yes, I do remember that.
Yeah. Before returning home to their Oak Street address, Cameron and Janice stopped at Jolly Cone for a fast food dinner.
Naturally.
As one does. Once home, Cameron parked in the garage and took the head box off Marliz. Cameron left for a minute, leaving Marliz and Janice alone, and Marliz begged Janice for her freedom. But Janice reassured Marliz that everything would be okay. Cameron returned and carried her into the basement while Janice stayed upstairs. Once alone in the basement, Marliz was screaming, and Cameron used a knife to cut her vocal cords. Unable to speak, Marliz motioned for a pen and paper. She wrote a note to Cameron that she could call her boyfriend for ransom money, but Cameron declined. Cameron stripped off her clothes and hung her up by her wrists and proceeded to torture her for hours. He shot her several times in the stomach with a pellet gun before he finally strangled her to death. Cameron then returned upstairs and told Janice that Marliz was dead. Janice was crying on the couch in a state of shock, and Cameron just held her. Janice told police that she thinks Cameron killed her because he lost control of the situation.
I actually believe that because I bet you he learned. And
right.
That's why he kept Colleen and like adjusted things with her.
Yep.
Ugh.
Around 2 a.m., Janice helped Cameron wrap Marliz's body in a blanket and put her in the trunk of the Colt. The couple drove into the mountains on snow-covered roads. They eventually reached a muddy side road where they pulled off. Cameron got out and dug a shallow grave, and once finished, Janice and Cameron retrieved Marliz from the trunk and buried her, arriving home before the sun came up. In order to cover up his trail, Cameron later burned Marliz's ID and personal belongings at a nearby dog park. Which I was thinking, wouldn't it be weird if you saw someone just like burning a barrel of garbage at a dog park?
Super, super suspicious.
Yeah. Janice told the police that Cameron did keep a souvenir, a small gold watch, which he wore until he lost it on a conveyor belt at work. In addition to detailing Marliz's murder, Janice Hooker also filled in all the details concerning Colleen's kidnapping and incarceration, mm-hmm. which we've covered pretty thoroughly at this point.
Yes.
Janice explained that Colleen never tried to escape because Cameron had completely brainwashed her.
Mm-hmm.
With all the information from Janice, the police began their investigation, seeking to verify the facts alleged by Janice. The police showed Janice a photo lineup of a missing young woman. Janice began tearing up and then easily chose Marliz from the photos. Mm. The police asked her how certain she was on a scale of 1 to 10. Janice said 9. It's just something you don't forget.
Mm.
Although they had Janice's compelling testimony, since she was an accomplice with immunity, her testimony would only hold up in court if the police could find some evidence to substantiate her claims.
Can you remind me, this was 1976, what year was, so that she went missing in 1976, but what year did, was all this arrest happening?
She went missing in January 1976, and this was at the end of 1974.
84, right? Because it was 84, after.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. 1984.
So it was like 8-ish years. I was trying to think, like, would her body be recognizable? And I don't think so.
No,
out in the mountains, in the mud.
Very much not recognizable.
Well, that's correct. Unfortunate.
Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, the police came up empty-handed.
Yes.
So police brought Janice up into the mountains to try to find Marliz's grave, but it had been too long and it had been dark, and Janice just couldn't be specific enough for them to find anything.
Yeah. Well, they
did
have,
look, though.
Yeah, I mean, they must have driven. I'm sure Cameron took her on all sorts of side roads and back roads. And
I know.
I can't believe she could even think that she would find it, to be honest.
I know. Maybe you would recognize something, but I would not. I can assure you.
Same.
No. They had far better luck in Colleen's case because they were able to go to the source. 5 days after Janice's initial discussions with Detective Shamblin, he flew down to Riverside to meet with Colleen. In a soft voice, almost like a whisper, Colleen confirmed the details. She explained the kidnapping, the slavery contract, the company, and the many devices used by Cameron to torture her, including the head box. Hmm. Her interview was tape recorded, and Detective Shamblin found her lucid and cooperative, but she had a disturbingly flat affect. She didn't overstate or dramatize anything, and she didn't shed a single tear during the whole interview. Her voice only faltered when she said that the only reason she was speaking to the police now was not for revenge, but to ensure it didn't happen again to anyone else.
I mean, I think it should have been a red flag that she wasn't the one originally going to the police anyway, that they had to come and interview her.
Right, and that it was his wife that sold him down the river.
Yeah.
Ugh. Janice and Colleen's stories matched up on the key details, and the police were able to corroborate additional facts like Colleen's employment at King's Lodge. They also got a warrant for the Oak Street address, and a quick search of the basement validated more pieces of the story.
I would think there's plenty of evidence.
Yeah, they were able to see like that concrete foundation where the workshop was.
Oh, that didn't even dawn on me that like obviously they would have taken all that down. Duh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. At this point, they had enough for a warrant. Mm-hmm. Cameron Hooker was arrested at his trailer on November 18th, 1984, for kidnapping, rape, sodomy, and other charges. He was advised of his Miranda rights, and he shut the fuck up and asked for a lawyer.
He's so annoying.
I know. Notably, Cameron's keys had a handcuff key on them. But, I mean, he's into BDSM, too, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, with Cameron's arrest came the town gossip. Those who spoke of Cameron described him as nice, courteous, friendly, and quiet. He was described as someone who was easy to get along with, but who kept his distance. Neighbors said that Cameron was the busiest on his property at night, with lights and electric saws going at all hours.
Yeah, I believe that.
I wouldn't call someone who did that like a nice, quiet neighbor.
That's true.
I would be like, no, he has bodies in his basement.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't know. Seems.
I thought you were going to go with like a noise complaint, but bodies in the basement is fair too.
Both.
Yeah.
Both. I go with both. Neighbors confirmed that they had seen the woman known as Kay with the Hookers and their children.
Oh, duh.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I didn't even think of that either.
Yep. They said Colleen was friendly and waved. The news was shocking given how benign Cameron was viewed. So locals speculated that Janice and Colleen were lesbian lovers out to frame Cameron.
Of course they did.
the town gossip is insane.
It's ridiculous.
Imagine if the internet existed at that time.
Oh, Red Bluff's talk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
is that the tabloid?
No, the like we have our town talks.
Oh, yes. Got you. Okay. Cameron hired a defense attorney named Roland Papendick. Roland went to interview Cameron in jail before he agreed to take the case. Roland asked Cameron how he met Colleen Stan, and he said he kidnapped her. And then Roland took the case anyways. Maybe he thought it would be a fun challenge. Yep. The case was to be prosecuted by Deputy District Attorney Christine McGuire, who was deemed the sexpert of the office. I don't think I would want that designation. No. She was the one to typically step up and take sex assault cases because many of her colleagues were insensitive to victims of sex crimes and either didn't want them or didn't take them seriously.
Oh, I'm annoyed about that, but glad that she was there.
But when Christine was assigned Colleen's case, she knew it was going to be different and her mind was boggled by the circumstances. She had to carefully analyze the facts to determine the charges, which was easier said than done in this case. Because the case spanned so many years, even if Cameron confessed to some of the crimes, he couldn't be prosecuted because of the statute of limitations.
Ugh.
In terms of the kidnapping charge, the statute of limitations was normally 3 years. However, Attorney McGuire was hoping to argue that the statute of limitations was extended by the detention created by a threat of force to Colleen.
Yes.
There was case law on her side, but it was distinguishable since it involved a minor and the court found the captor was exercising parental authority. It ultimately wouldn't matter, but we'll get to that.
I'm also interested that it doesn't apply when the person confesses. Or that it does apply, rather, when the person confesses.
They confess because they can't be prosecuted for it. They wouldn't confess otherwise.
I also just sat back in my chair like I didn't have to talk into the microphone because I was so intrigued already. I should probably sit up.
Yeah, okay. you need to be close to the microphone. The first hurdle for Christine was the preliminary hearing, at which evidence would be presented for the judge to determine if there was enough evidence for the case to proceed. The state called Janice and Colleen to testify at that hearing, and their testimony was enough, if you could believe it.
Uh-huh.
The judge ruled that Cameron would have to face charges of kidnapping, rape, sodomy, oral copulation, and rape with a foreign object. The judge said the case was, quote, extremely serious and, to put it mildly, bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
And if the charges were true, Cameron would certainly be a danger to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron's bail was maintained at $500,000.
Well, I guess this is 84, so that's a lot.
That's a lot
of money. Okay.
He didn't have.
Yeah.
He didn't have that. Yeah. Now came the hard work to prepare this monstrosity of a case for trial. Although there wasn't enough evidence to charge Cameron with Marliz's murder, Christine wasn't going to give up that easily. They had Janice's testimony, but she had immunity, so her word wasn't enough. But it was obviously more than just coincidental.
Hold on. Can you go back to what you said? Janice's testimony wasn't enough because she had immunity?
Yes.
Can you say more about that?
Is
it like a conflict of interest? Kind of like they think
her credibility would be shot
because she's going to say it because she benefits from saying, giving that testimony.
It's her word against his, and she's getting immunity. Okay. Like she's saying, oh, we murdered her, but she's not going to get in trouble for it. So she's not believable.
Okay. Thank you.
So they need, that wouldn't be sufficient on its own to meet their burden of proof.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But Janice's allegations were corroborated by the fact that Marliz had gone missing from where Janice said. She'd been wearing the outfit described by Janice, and Janice knew she went by the name Marliz.
Yep.
She lived where Janice had identified. Janice told the police that Cameron had kept her gold watch. One of Cameron's former coworkers confirmed she remembered him wearing a woman's watch before he lost it on a conveyor belt at work.
Exactly what Janice said.
Yep. And Janice had also identified her quickly in the photo lineup.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot for Janet to just guess correctly.
Yeah, even just identifying the photo. How could you possibly pick out the right person if you had no idea?
But in this situation, Grimm's theme song ran true. Nobody, no crime.
Oh, that's right.
But I think we've discussed this before. Christine was going to introduce the murder as evidence of a prior similar act, which only requires proof by a preponderance of the evidence rather than guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So the prior bad act can be introduced for the limited purpose of shedding light on the defendant's motive, intent, preparation, or disposition to commit such acts, aka his MO or modus operandi.
Okay, so you're introducing in the kidnapping for Colleen, you're introducing that there, you're introducing that he murdered Marliz, but you don't have to prove, as you would in a murder trial for Marliz, the burden of, you don't have the burden of proof in the same way beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct. It's just a preponderance of the evidence.
Preponderance meaning for our gremlins who may not know what that means.
So beyond a reasonable doubt is a lot, you know, any doubt that a reasonable person would have. Preponderance of the evidence is more likely than not. Basically.
Okay.
It's like 51%.
That's my word of the day. Thank you.
You're welcome. So she wants to use Marliz's kidnap and murder to show that Colleen was not in this consensually, because that's part of the defense. He's saying that she
wanted
it, and it was all consensual.
Ooh, okay.
So she's using it to show that he has done bad things before to try to prove her case against Colleen.
Which makes sense, because if Cameron's defense was good, they'd be like, well, Colleen didn't go to the police.
Right.
Janice did, and Janice is the jealous blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Yep. I'm a lawyer.
Yeah, and that just goes to show you the difference with Janice's testimony alone. It was enough for the preponderance of the evidence standard. But with her having immunity and her credibility being shot, it's not enough to get over the threshold
for a
criminal conviction.
Okay. I love Marina's legal corner.
You
I'm
love
actually
when I talk lawyer to you?
I do.
So going over the similarities between Marliz and Colleen's cases, they were picked up in the hooker's Dodge, taken down a dirt road, threatened, bound, put in the head box.
That one in particular is real unique circumstances.
The head box, sketchy.
Uh-huh.
They both sat in the car while the hookers ate a fast food meal.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. They were smuggled into the Oak Street house after dark, taken to the basement, stripped, and hung by their wrists. So,
and tortured and, yep.
Pretty similar.
Yep.
Christine filed her motion to include the prior bad act, and it was granted by the court, but the court noted that the evidence was only relevant to Cameron's intent to kidnap.
Right.
Because that's where the similarities ended.
Okay.
That evidence would be bad for Cameron.
Yeah.
So what did he do? After discussing it with his counsel, Cameron decided he would admit to the kidnapping of Colleen so that the evidence about Marliz wouldn't come in. The only bright side was that once the public heard that Cameron was being investigated for murder, opinions began to sway and it became more believable that he could have done what he did to Colleen.
Hold on a minute. So he admitted that he kidnapped Colleen?
Mm-hmm. To keep the information about Marliz out.
Oh.
And because there were statute of limitations issues with the kidnapping charge.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
But wait, you said, so he's on that when people learned that he was on trial for murder, but he's not on trial for murder.
No. Did I say on trial?
I think so.
Investigated for murder.
Oh. Okay.
So once they heard that there was this sort of link between him and Marliz, they were like,
got it.
Oh, like that's weird.
Okay.
So it swayed opinions.
You thought that maybe I wouldn't have as much commentary because I would just listen, but no, I have more because I need to understand everything.
Yes, and Marina's legal corner is just filled with me saying things and then you asking me questions that I like don't know the answer to normally. That's like how we do it.
But you knew preponderance, so
that is the most basic. Anybody watching, like, I was going to say CSI, Law and Order, should know preponderance of the evidence.
Well, I haven't watched it in a while and I usually fall asleep.
Don't know. Well, if you stayed awake, you'd know that standard.
Yeah.
So the public talking about this and changing their opinion of Cameron, that was a problem for the defense. Because of all the media coverage in Northern California, defense counsel sought a change of venue.
Sure.
The judge warned that a move would be expensive and inconvenient, but both attorneys were on board. The defense wanted to get away from the horrendous publicity, while the state wanted to get away from Cameron's sympathetic neighbors.
Oh, yeah. Because you never want to believe it's one of your own.
Right.
You know, somebody nearby, how could you have missed this the whole time? Because it says something about them.
Well, not only that, they saw.
That's what I mean.
Colleen and Kay all the time.
Yeah.
Like just jogging the neighborhood.
Exactly.
And,
yep.
So the motion was granted. And now it was time to prepare for trial. Remember I said in part two that Janice and Cameron decided one night that they should destroy everything and burned it all in the burn barrel?
Yes.
Well, luckily they missed a few things. After executing several search warrants, investigators happened to find the negative for a photo of Colleen's slave contract.
I literally have goosebumps. Oh my God, of all things to find.
So good. And Cameron developed all of his own photos. So they also found undeveloped film that had to be sent out to the FBI for processing.
Oh, man.
The film was developed and they found photos of Janice, but they also found a photo of Colleen. She was incredibly bony and she was hung up in a way that made it look as though she was being crucified and she was wearing the slave collar.
Oh, oh, goosebumps.
Incredible find for the prosecution. Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
The prosecution was a little nervous about this case, given how absolutely bizarre and unfathomable the facts and circumstances were. So they wanted to make sure that the jury got the full picture of everything to ensure a conviction. Christine had the full waterbed coffin reconstructed so that she could crawl in and demonstrate that all of Colleen's claims were plausible.
Oh my God. First of all, props to her, because I couldn't. Even for someone, even to make this happen, I don't know that I could do that. But that poor jury, to get all of this, not just to see that, but to hear all the details. And
I think the prosecutor put the head box on, or they put it on, somebody put the head box on when they were preparing for trial and like immediately panicked. They were like, even with all of these people around us, like the sensory deprivation, and they're like, we cannot even imagine.
And she not only wore it like at all, but for years.
Yeah.
Well, the head box, not for years, but still.
But can you imagine like how scared you are being kidnapped and that sensory deprivation? No.
Wow.
So now the question was, would this case ever make it to trial?
Oh.
Cameron's defense was that all of the sex acts were consensual, although he had to admit to the kidnapping to keep Marliz's kidnapping out of court.
Right.
The defense wanted to dispose of the case via a plea bargain.
I figured.
Roland Papendick told Christine that Cameron would plead guilty to kidnapping if all of the sex charges were dropped.
No.
You can waive the statute of limitations.
Oh, sure.
Like, that's a thing.
Yeah.
So Christine was firmly against the deal. However, the district attorney told her to jump at it. You know why? Because the county couldn't afford to try Cameron's case.
No.
When they had transferred the case, they transferred it to a small county, Tahoma County. I think it's Tahoma County.
I don't trust your pronunciation of anything today.
No, it's really bad today. I'm so sorry. This little county was broke.
Oh, no.
And Cameron's case was estimated to cost between $100,000 and $250,000 to try.
Oh, no.
And the county had already been implementing budget cuts, shutting down parks and libraries, laying off employees, cutting down the work week from 5 to 4 days, which I fully support.
Yeah.
The board of supervisors said if Cameron was tried, they would have to lay off 20 to 50 county employees.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
That math doesn't work, I don't think. I guess it does, maybe, but go on. It's unimportant.
No, it would, because if you had like 50 employees making $30,000, right?
No, 250,000 divided by 50 is 5,000.
Okay, well, there are probably a lot of like odd jobs around.
Well, then that dawned on me, like maybe they're not full time.
Yeah, employees. Like how much do you think the lifeguard is making at the local pool? Okay,
all right. I'm sorry.
I took it from the book.
I suppose that's not where I need to be adding commentary.
No, but it's okay.
Sometimes, I'm paying very close attention.
Sometimes my math ain't mathin'.
That's true.
Christine was devastated about this, but she didn't have much choice. She called Roland Papendick and told him she would drop the sex charges, but she wanted him to plead to kidnap, abduction to live in an illicit relationship, and false imprisonment. Hmm. Roland spoke to his client, and they smugly accepted the deal.
Oh.
Based on the original charges, Cameron would be facing 115 years. With the new plea, he was only facing about 10 years and could be out in as little as 4.5 years with good behavior. Laura's distressed.
But I know you have more pages there, so I have hope.
This was far from justice, and Christine couldn't let it stand. She needed help. So she called Colleen's civil attorney and told her that Cameron was going to get off on a minor charge because the county was broke. And she was like, even though this violates the penal code, which says you can't plea bargain serious felonies for any reason other than insufficient evidence, inability to get testimony from a material witness, or if the plea won't result in a substantial change in the sentence. That's part of the penal code.
And but it would, right? The last one, it does apply. It would. It does have a significant difference, doesn't it?
It does. And it's also... Yeah. It's not for any of those reasons. She had evidence. She was able to get her witnesses, and it would substantially change it.
Oh, if it well, okay.
So she was like, yeah, like even though this is illegal, like I have to do it. So wow. The civil attorney was like, okay, well, fuck that. So she made a bunch of calls, and it made its way to the attorney general's office, who called Christine and was like, what the hell is going on over there?
Yeah.
And they said that if the county wasn't going to try Cameron, the AG's office would step in and then they would bill the county, which would cost them even more money.
Oh, wow.
Yep. So Christine took this to the DA and he was like, well, it's out of my hands if the AG's office says it. Yep. So despite the financial restraints, Christine was given the green light to send Cameron to trial.
Wow.
And can you imagine if he had been able to plead and get off with 4.5 years? Yeah.
Oh, man.
Like, this is one of those things where, like, I just had to include all the details. Because, like, can you fucking imagine? Like, he almost got off because the county was broke.
And we always say that it's so frustrating because on TV, everything's about, like, oh, you know, evidence and all this. And, yes, evidence is important. Mm-hmm. But it's, like, it seems like it's always a technicality. And, right. Of course, if you're the defense, of course you're looking for that. You're mm-hmm. looking for anything to get out.
Yep.
That would, I would have quit, I think, if that had been it. If you would have been, like, and if you're enjoying grandma. I would have been out.
Yeah, there were too many pages left.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah. So Cameron was set to be tried on 16 felony counts. One of kidnapping with a special allegation of having used a knife while kidnapping her. 7 rape charges, forced oral copulation, forced penetration with a foreign object, forced sodomy, 3 false imprisonment charges, and 2 of abducting to live in an illicit relationship.
That's a new one. Haven't heard that one.
That's because it's from 1905.
Literally.
Literally. Okay. Literally. A jury was impaneled that consisted of 5 men and 7 women with 2 alternates who were both women. 8 of the 12 jurors had at least some college education. So,
okay.
It was a good panel.
Yep.
The parties were entitled to opening statements and then evidence began. The state started with Janice Hooker. Christine walked her through the whole ordeal again through questioning, which we've covered in depth, while the box was on full display in the courtroom.
Every time I picture this, also for poor Colleen.
I know.
Not obviously to have to relive and tell it all, mm-hmm. but then to see it. And I assume Cameron's right there.
Right there. Right? Yep. Sitting right there. Ugh. Yep. Christine questioned Janice on direct examination for 2.5 days.
I thought you were going to say hours.
Days.
Oh my God.
Days. When she was done, Roland was given the opportunity for cross-examination, which he only took just a few hours. But Roland used that time to efficiently plant seeds of doubt. He questioned Janice about a time that she had told Colleen that she could just go after Colleen and Janice had been arguing. Apparently, Colleen told Janice in response that God didn't want her to go yet. Colleen also told Janice that God had put her in the Hooker home to straighten out her life with drugs and stuff. Janice testified on cross-examination that she believed Colleen was becoming fond of Cameron by 1980 and that she would cook him special things and put makeup on before he got home. Janice testified that in the summer of 1980, Colleen went water skiing with the family at Black Butte Lake, and she went on vacation with them in July of 1984 to Burney Falls, and there was a photograph of them all smiling together. She even went on a snow skiing trip with them in the winter of 1979. Roland was trying to show that Colleen was a happy member of the Hooker family.
Imagine if you're the jury listening to this. Like, this is an unbelievable story, and we know it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine listening and thinking, there's no fucking way. That may seem very reasonable. You may be like, yeah, you were fine. You know, how could this possibly have happened? It seems like, you know what I mean? Like, I wonder if you're thinking that as the jury. Like, it's so... The truth is so unbelievable. It's almost beyond a reasonable doubt.
I know.
Like it's crazy.
And can you imagine sitting there while this evidence came out? You'd be like, oh my God. And then you'd be like, oh wait, no, she's lying.
oh my God. Like, I would just go back and forth. I'd be like, oh my God. Yeah, no, he did it. No, he didn't do it. No, he did it. No, I don't know. He didn't do it. You're supposed to reserve judgment till the end, though.
I would not be a very good juror. I'd be raising my hand and be like, excuse me, can you go back?
Can I vote now? Can I vote? On redirect, Christine elicited testimony from Janice to point out that when Cameron was affectionate to Colleen, Colleen was still blindfolded and chained, and Colleen had to ask permission to do anything because she was too afraid to disobey. Mm-hmm. Not quite the normal happy family situation that Roland was trying to paint.
No.
The state's second witness was Colleen, and she started from the very beginning, which is a very good place to start.
Anything about deer? Okay.
A female deer. She detailed the kidnapping and the horrors of the head box. A woman was brought into the courtroom wearing clothes similar to what Colleen was wearing the day that she was kidnapped, and the box was snapped over the woman's head to show that it worked. During Colleen's testimony, she didn't get upset because she said, quote, she's been through it all. She told the jury about being punished in 1978 or 1979 with the electrical wires for doing a macrame project incorrectly. Janice was angry and told Cameron when he got home, who set her up with those wires that we discussed in the last episode. He gagged Colleen when she screamed, and he told her that she better start obeying and show more respect. Some of Colleen's testimony contradicted Janice's, but on a small scale. She denied being affectionate to Cameron, cooking him special meals, or putting on makeup. She denied ever being told by Janice that she could go, denied hugging or kissing Cameron, and denied ever telling Janice that she enjoyed having sex with Cameron. I picture some of this, like, Janice's perception of what was happening is skewed by a sense of jealousy.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. So I'm sure that things that Colleen was doing to stay alive and stay sane.
Yes.
Janice viewed.
I think in that's a different absolutely light. Correct. Or you just have a bad memory. Mm-hmm. Like, you just forget. And because you're colored with thinking, oh, I thought that Colleen was into him.
Right.
That's what you assume the memory was. So, yep.
Christine had to address Colleen's alleged love for Cameron. Colleen testified that in 1980, she told Cameron she loved him out of fear.
Yeah.
Because she thought that if he thought she loved him, he would treat her better. Cameron told her that someday Colleen would have his baby. And Colleen said that as long as the choice was up to her, she did not want that. She testified that she didn't understand why she ever had any feelings towards Cameron because she feels he's now, quote, a very terrible person. When Christine was done, Roland went to work to destroy Colleen's credibility.
Oh, no.
The most damaging pieces of evidence were in the form of letters from Colleen. In May of 1980, Colleen had given Cameron a card that said, "Happy third anniversary." Inside the card read, quote, "Sometimes I feel that being your slave has made me more of a woman. But then there are other times when I feel it has made me less of a woman. You know how to make me feel good about myself, and I love you so much for it. I only wish that my dreams could be fulfilled with you. Because I feel a strong love and need to be with you, I'll always serve you with singleness of heart, K."
Wow. I'm really just trying to put myself in the seat of the jury, and I'd be like, wow, that sounds like a woman in a really fucked up but consensual relationship.
Right?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Let's trudge on. There was another letter from Christmas. This one's a little long, but these are important. Yeah. And I'm just, you're either in here for all the detail or you're not at this point. So, quote, "This is my Christmas letter to express and give my love to my master. You asked me to tell you how much I love you, but I haven't ever been able to tell you because I don't know the right words to describe how much I love you. But I seem to be falling deeper and deeper into love with you with each passing day. I find love hard for me to express with words, but you bring the passion out in me, and it's a way of expressing my love for you. You've also spiritually inspired me, and I can't tell you how much I love you for it, more than any words I know could ever tell. It's not easy being a slave, but your love makes it worth being your slave. I hope that you're right about how things will change for the better and that I'll have your child someday. I promise you I'll give you a son. I know you'll be proud of him, and I hope you'll love him as much as you love me. I know that you know I have great faith in God. I read this in St. Luke. For with God, nothing shall be impossible. And I think you know how important it is to me to do everything with God in my heart. I need and want his guidance and strength. I can't explain how happy it made me feel inside when you told me that if I ever have your child, that you would take me as your spiritual wife. I pray it will be someday, that God will recognize our love and commitment and that he'll join us to be one, and that even though I'll be your bond maid, parens slave, and second wife, that no one or anything will ever separate us. I wish you a merry, merry Christmas and the best of New Year's. I pray that God will always hear your prayers and always answer them, and that the Holy Ghost will always be with you to guide you and to give you insight and understanding so that you will always do that which will make your soul feel good. I love you more than words could ever say. K.
Whoa. So in the very beginning, I thought, okay, it's kind of telling when it says, you asked me to tell you how much I love you.
Yes.
But she got really like it, that kept going. Mm. But again, knowing the situation, I can easily say, of course, a combination of like, you're trying to just pretend like if this is your life now, right, why not lean in?
Right.
You know, but the jury doesn't know that. The no. jury hasn't heard. I mean, they've heard a lot of the evidence, but they haven't heard it told the way I just have.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hear that as a jury member and think, same thing. Wow. She was in love with him.
I know, it corroborates his defense.
Yeah.
Oof. There was a third card.
Oh no.
That said on the outside, just because I love you. Inside it said, love is not a single act, but a climate in which we live, a lifetime venture in which we are always learning, discovering, growing. It is not destroyed by a single failure, nor won by a single caress. You cannot learn to love by loving one person only, for love is a climate of the heart. My love for you is growing with every changing day. You fill my life with happiness and love, and I pray that happiness and love will never end. Love, K.
Goodness.
Also, isn't that beautiful?
I was just thinking that, and that actually made me wonder, maybe she was just like letting herself lose herself in right. writing this and imagining, obviously not him.
Right.
And just to the concept of loving and imagining, this is what I would write to my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know all that because
I know
parts one and two.
I know. Wow. And remember, she used to write poetry with her neck chained to the toilet in the back bathroom.
Mm-hmm. What a memory. But mm-hmm. yes.
Let's go back. Colleen was asked about the letters, and she testified that she thinks she wrote them because Cameron told her to. There so that go. Goes to your I point.
I fully believe that. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Roland also went through dates in which Colleen was out of the box, dates she went to bars or jogging or is outside doing yard work. He also thoroughly reviewed the phone record showing calls between Colleen's father's house and the Hooker residence, with most calls being more than 20 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Roland excused her after that. But the phone records that Colleen was asked about were admitted into evidence, and the jury was read the details of all 29 calls spanning a 4-month time span. In the hallway, a CNN cameraman who had watched the trial told a friend, I think he's going to get off. She's just not convincing enough.
Oof. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
The last two witnesses called by the state were a doctor and a psychologist. The doctor, Dr. Vovacs, just don't trust my pronunciation.
I'm it's not.
Fine. Could be Vovacs.
Really?
Vovacs.
I would never have gotten that. Okay.
I think Vovacs. Okay. Was tasked with explaining the state of Colleen's body after a thorough examination. Mm. The doctor testified that Colleen's hair was thinner than one would expect for an adult female. Mm. The doctor marked up a diagram of a female body to indicate where Colleen's body was scarred, including on her wrist bones, which were consistent with the use of handcuffs. Mm. He noted that her right wrist had more scarring, which was consistent with a right-handed person struggling more with their dominant side if restrained. Oh. Colleen had matching scars on both ankles, again with more scarring on the right side. Never even thought of that. Makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor testified to the scars on Colleen's upper inner thigh that he confirmed were consistent with electrical burns. He said he could tell by the unusual rounded areas at the top portion of the burn scar. And the doctor also confirmed that there was a pierced hole in Colleen's right labia.
All of these things confirm what we know, mm-hmm. but none of these things say that it was not consensual.
Correct. You're right.
Ugh.
The final witness called by the state was Dr. Hatcher, who was an associate clinical professor and the director of the family therapy program at the Langley Porter Institute in San Francisco. His background included training programs involving hypnosis, terrorism, and victim behavior, and he'd received grants to research hostage behavior. He wrote papers relating to hostage behavior, violent behavior within adults, and persuasive ability, and had worked with agencies like the U.S. Department of Justice, Scotland Yard, Hong Kong Police, and the Secret Service, to name a few.
Wow. But this is who you need, because up until now, like I said, you've only shown what you need to. You also need to show how serious all of these things are. But you have to show that she was a prisoner, that she was kidnapped, and she was tortured against her will.
This comes down to the psychology
of it. Exactly.
This is how you differentiate.
Yep.
Yes. And explain her behavior. Mm-hmm. And this man was thoroughly qualified to do
so. I would say so.
Now, again, this information about him is long, but it's so interesting.
Marina, you could talk for the next three hours and I'm here.
You're like leaning forward. You're like, okay. So Dr. Hatcher explained coercion as a continuum. That was the question he was asked to define, or the word he was asked to define, coercion. He said on one side of the spectrum is pressure exerted to do all types of things every day. In the center is coercion, in which extraordinary pressure is being brought upon an individual to perform or do an act. It can be physical, mental, or psychological pressure. And then on the far end is brainwashing, which is when a person's entire view of the world is changed, which he said was very rare. So Dr. Hatcher could not be asked to specifically opine as to Colleen's case, but he could testify to hypotheticals and confirm that in a case like Colleen's, she would have been coerced into a desired behavior pattern and would give up any overt resistance.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But still, again, this is literally, you have to prove that she believed in the company.
Right.
You know, like you have to prove that.
Yeah. Oof. And Dr. Hatcher was also asked by the state about the term or the phrase breaking a person. He explained that breaking a person involved techniques that were initially developed by the Soviets and the Chinese to establish coercion to the point that a person would give up any resistance and do as they're told. There are 16 steps, and I'm going to list them all because it's wild how closely they align to Cameron's treatment of Colleen. The first step. Now, no one study this, okay? This is informational purposes only.
Just listen, no learning.
The first step of breaking a person is a sudden, unexpected abduction followed by isolation. The person should be placed in a cell-like environment, remove their clothes, and begin humiliating them.
Okay, did you have to say should be? Because it does sound like instructions.
Sorry. The second step, you should go get some... No. The second step involves physically or sexually abusing the person to demonstrate how vulnerable they are.
Yeah.
The third step is removing normal daylight patterns by putting someone in constant dark or light environment to disorient them. The fourth step involves controlling urination, defecation, and menstruation and to be present when these things are going on to ruin a person's sense of privacy. The fifth step is to control and reduce food and water. And then the sixth step is to punish for no apparent rhyme or reason so that they don't know what's going on. The seventh step is to require the captive to ask permission to do anything and then establish a pattern of sexual and physical abuse to show someone what their new life will be like. Step nine is continued isolation. Step 10 is involving presenting a model for how to please the captor. The 11th step is to threaten to sell the captive to an even worse master. I know. That's why it's crazy, right?
I like literally think he read these.
Yeah.
I'm not even.
I know. The 13th is to continue to beat and torture the captive at irregular intervals. The 14th step is called irrelevant leniency, which is allowing small privileges for no reason. The 15th step is to obtain further confessions and signed documents from the captor to show more control in writing. And the 16th and final technique is to incorporate new behaviors for your captive.
I think he found this in a book in the library because I sound like I'm joking, but I'm actually not because I thought it was kind of random that all of a sudden he wanted the slave documents. Like that he just like came up with that and was like, now I think I'll have this. So now I think he really did read something.
Well, he saw that in one of his magazine articles.
And maybe they read that.
Well, Dr. Hatcher was asked about where someone would find the information about breaking a person. And he said that you either see it in the study of psychology, which I don't think Cameron was studying for his PhD in psychology, in law enforcement, or in BDSM literature. With all this information.
Oh my God.
I know. So basically, Christine walked Dr. Hatcher through the hypothetical situations that mirrored Colleen's situation, which again, we know all the information. Yeah. So we're like, God damn. Like we're making the connections real quick on our own. Yeah. So Christine walked the doctor through these things, and then Dr. Hatcher went on to explain Colleen's behavior. I'm having a hard time with the C's. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
With the names. Yeah.
Did you realize that Hatcher's not a C?
Hatcher's not. And then I was like, it's Janice, but it's Cameron, Colleen, and Christine. Anyways, my brain is having a hard time braining this evening.
It's okay. It did all the braining to put this together, and it did. Fantastic.
Thank you. And now it's struggling to
try to read it.
Yeah. I'm going to give it to you to finish it off. So Dr. Hatcher explained the letters that Colleen wrote. He said that they were consistent with sadomasochistic literature where the captive is asked to echo the captor's belief system.
Oh.
So that goes to what you said, where you picked up right in the very beginning where she was like, you've asked me to tell you how much I love you.
Mm-hmm.
In explaining why Colleen never fled, Dr. Hatcher explained that after a while, curiosity sets in and a captor becomes interested in seeing just how far they can let a person go and still have control over them. So it's like, even though he was letting her go, that fear was instilled in there, and that it's not unusual for a captive to let the captor go.
Other way around, but got you. Mm-hmm, yep. But as the captor, I bet you're feeling even more power if you're like, because it's one thing if you have them in handcuffs in your basement.
Yes.
But if you're like, oh, look, I can let her go for a jog and I know I'm so powerful that she'll come back.
Okay. Ugh. You should be a psychologist, because that was literally in the book, that discussion of it.
Damn.
Where they're saying it makes them feel more powerful and there is an inherent risk in letting them off into the world. Yep. But it's like the further they go or the more freedom they're given and the fact that they come back, it just...
If you love something, let it go. Go on.
And fucking run. Run. In discussing the phone calls that Colleen had made after her escape, Dr. Hatcher explained that a captive speaking with a captor after the fact without being put back in captivity begins to help them reestablish control in their lives and helps their brain get over the fact that they were taken. He also explained that many victims avoid pressing charges so that they do not have to relive the experience in court, which that one's
fair. Yeah. And she is anyway.
Yeah.
Unfair.
The direct examination of Dr. Hatcher took 2 days. In conclusion, Dr. Hatcher opined that the circumstances described by Christine would be unique in that there would be no similar situation in which this degree of captivity or sadomasochistic torture of a human being had ever existed.
That's because Fritzl hadn't happened yet.
Hadn't it?
Wasn't that in the 90s?
But that wasn't sadomasochistic.
And it wasn't. And she was also not let go. So it's...
Yes. Correct.
Yeah. So he is correct.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. On cross-examination, Roland tried to belittle the doctor for being a psychologist as opposed to a psychiatrist.
Oh my God.
But Dr. Hatcher had fully established himself as being more than competent to testify on this subject. Roland asked Dr. Hatcher about the term coercive persuasion, which doesn't have a generally accepted definition of the field of psychology. But again, no one cared.
Right.
Roland tried to discredit Dr. Hatcher, but ended up assisting the state's case. He asked about the effects one sees in a coercive situation, and Dr. Hatcher said the most interesting effect was numbness of affect. He explained that someone could describe the most appalling situation and display no emotion.
Oh, you mean exactly like Colleen did?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Dr. Hatcher also explained that a captive would want to get their life back and put up a normal facade before they can go back and start to heal from their captivity.
Sure.
Which we talked about that. She like went home and was like, I need a job right now.
Right. I mean, I get it. First of all, what else are you going to do?
Right.
But wow.
Yeah. After failing to gain any ground in his favor, Roland ended by asking if Dr. Hatcher was familiar with his own expert, Dr. Donald T. Lund, who Dr. Hatcher confirmed he considered an expert in forensic psychiatry. And with that, he excused the witness.
Mm-hmm.
In sum, the state called a total of 19 witnesses, and now it was the defense's turn.
Dun, dun, dun.
On Friday, October 18th, the halls of the courthouse were packed with excited anticipation that Cameron Hooker would be taking the stand to testify on his own behalf.
Oh my God, that seems like a terrible idea for the defense.
He kind of has no choice.
I guess.
Because the two people in his life that he said he was in a consensual relationship were both like, no, he raped the shit out of her.
Yeah.
So really, he was between a rock and a hard place.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it's never a good idea.
No.
Like Colleen and Janice, Cameron's account of Colleen's initial kidnapping was consistent, but then the details began to change. Cameron said he never held the knife to Colleen's throat. It was just her chest or stomach area. So that's better. Roland straight up asked, why did you kidnap her? He said, I had a fantasy of practicing bondage on a girl who couldn't say no. Cameron said him and Janice had kicked around the idea of kidnapping a slave, but that the idea to do it to Colleen occurred while they were riding in the car. He didn't even know that he was going to kidnap Colleen.
Also, he wanted to kidnap a girl who couldn't say no. That is not consensual.
Correct. Oh, he's admitting. Like, he's admitting
well, in to the kidnapping, yes. But yes. In general, like, clearly you're going after something non-consensual.
Right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then when he was asked, though, how Janice would know the plan about kidnapping Colleen in the car, he said that they have a way of communicating without words. And that's how Janice knew that he was going to do it before he even knew he was going to do it.
Oh, my God.
Cameron said that the first night, he felt really bad about what he had gotten himself into. He put Colleen in an old sadomasochistic crate that him and Janice had used in the past, and he said he checked on her several times that first night because he was worried about her. He testified that he planned to let her go, but he couldn't let her go that day for some reason, so he was planning on doing it the next day. He testified that in the meantime, he built a table so that she could lie down. He denied hanging her up, and by the third day, he felt it was safe to let her go. He said she was hitchhiking on drugs and had drugs in her purse, so he didn't think she posed a threat. He said when he went downstairs and took off the head box to let her go, Colleen proceeded to describe almost exactly where they lived, so he began to panic. He wanted to let her go, but he was afraid that he was going to get in trouble. It just wasn't the dreamy situation that he thought that it would be.
Right.
He testified that during this time, Colleen was downright sick. He said he spent several hours with her in the basement, holding her hand and talking to her. He said Colleen asked for the drugs in her purse, but Cameron had already thrown them away. And over the next few weeks, Colleen was very ill, sweating and shaking, and Colleen was unrestrained this whole time. Cameron spent hours with her, and they would talk and hug. Colleen confided in Cameron about her parents, her past, all of it. And Cameron said once Colleen was better after week two, Cameron had built the box, and Colleen was kept in it unrestrained until he would come home from work.
What?
Cameron testified that she would be out of the box, unbound for 4 to 6 hours a day, and that she slept a lot those first couple months. This story makes it no fucking sense. Like, I think he needed something better. I don't
That's
know.
That's what I'm saying. Like, all right, fine. You have to testify, but what am I supposed to follow? At first I was like, okay, are you going for like, oh, I helped her detox and all that, but in a box?
Like, she slept a lot in the box.
What?
She's like a detoxing vampire.
Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But unrestrained.
She wasn't restrained. Correct.
Right.
Yes. But she was in the box. Distinction without a difference, really. Yeah. I'd rather be restrained out of the box.
True.
Cameron's biggest concern was how to let her go without ending up in jail. Cameron confirmed that Colleen did not bathe those first 2 weeks. But after that, he said she bathed once or twice a week, blindfolded. Your face.
It's just the audacity. Again, I know. What is he going to do? Admit all the details? Of course not. But I'm just offended, I guess, that because there's like a little bit of like, yeah, he did blindfold her.
Right.
She was blindfolded and then submerged with a broomstick.
Right.
It just is offending me.
Yeah. How
I just imagine because he knows what
Smug.
He's doing.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm mad.
After 3 months, Janice and Cameron built the workshop so that Colleen didn't have to be stuck laying down during the day and could do what she wanted, like shell walnuts. Cameron said that during the first 3 months, he only hung Colleen up twice. The first time he hung her up, she started crying, so he let her down. And the second time, he hung her up for about 15 minutes. He said the longest he ever hung Colleen or Jan was about 20 minutes because he read that was the maximum amount of time for a tourniquet in a Boy Scouts book.
Right. He probably did read that.
I'm sure he did. By the way, Cameron did admit on the stand that he dunked Colleen. He said he tied her up and put her face in the water, but he was careful not to let her choke. He said matter-of-factly he had done it with Janice before and wanted to do it to Colleen.
But even, I'm curious about, I wish I knew his exact wording of this, because how mm-hmm. you're saying is, like, do it to Colleen.
Right.
And that's still not admitted. I'm sure that's not enough to prove that it wasn't consensual, but still, like, I'm hearing all of this that's like, him saying, I did it to her. And
right.
You know.
Yes. But you have to remember, like, BDSM culture, it's like a whole culture. Yeah. It's, you know.
Yeah.
Roland asked if Colleen was allowed upstairs in the first 6 months. Cameron said no, except the time she took a bath, which is weird because he had just said that she was allowed to bathe once or twice a week.
Well, yeah, she was showering then. I'm just kidding.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Concerning the slavery contract, Cameron said it was Janice's idea. He said he showed Janice the article about the slavery contract, and Janice thought it would be a great way to keep Colleen from going to the police. After Colleen signed the contract, she was allowed upstairs every night. Cameron confirmed the existence of the attention drills, and he said he started them after his brother came over unannounced and Colleen didn't move as quick as he wanted.
But doesn't all of this say non-consensual? Because if it were consensual, wouldn't you just be like, hey, can you go downstairs? Like, I don't, how is this?
Because it's the control aspect of it. It's not kidnapping for him to be exerting control over her if she's there of her own volition.
Okay.
It's unfathomable.
Yeah.
The whole situation. Yeah. And that's part of it. It's like this fucked up BDSM love triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And the state is just trying to like wade through the bullshit to make sure that the jury does not buy into
exactly
that storyline of it.
Which, because that's actually more plausible than to the layperson, I think, than this crazy kidnapped, abducted and tortured for 7 years.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That she just like took the kids out to the market and then like brought them home and crawled into her box.
Like it's, that's unfathomable.
It is.
But BDSM is, they're like, okay, that's an okay thing. And people do that. And I don't understand it, but it's a thing, you know?
Right.
So you're, I feel like you're going to be more likely to believe that.
Right.
Ugh.
Yep. Cameron said Colleen started out sweet, but she was starting to be depressed after she signed the slavery contract. He blamed this partially on Janice treating Colleen like a slave. Nothing to do with Cameron.
No.
Cameron denied ever punishing Colleen and said he always talked to her in a soft voice so that all he had to do was talk harshly for her to know she was in trouble.
Okay.
Okay, Cameron. Worried about her depressed attitude, Cameron and Janice came up with the idea to buy her out of the company contract, something that had never been done before. Once Cameron said the buyout was complete, Colleen cheered up. Cameron said they were planning to move in a few months and asked if Colleen wanted to hang around and help, and Colleen agreed, although Cameron said she still slept in the box or the workshop and was treated like a slave in the interim.
Oh my God.
It's not funny. No. I'm laughing because it's bullshit. It's
ridiculous. Yes. That's why.
When they moved, Cameron said putting Colleen in the box was inconvenient, so unless they had company, she was kept unrestrained in the back bathroom since he was about to let her go anyways to see if she believed in the company. Tell me how that makes sense.
None of this makes sense.
No. Why would... Yeah, no. Anyways, the whole story checks out. It's seamless. There's no contradictions. So...
It's... what's that phrase you have? You're trying to use logic to get you out of a situation that an irrational person put you in. What is it?
You can't use logic to talk yourself out of a position that you didn't use logic to talk yourself into.
Close enough.
Yeah. It was close. Cameron admitted to telling Colleen stories about the company, but he denied ever having threatened her family. Cameron said during this time, Colleen's attitude was really happy, and he was happy to have Colleen around. He said she did what he really wanted Janice to do, and he would practice bondage with her in the woods, hug and kiss her, and indulge in petting. Cameron said the affection was not part of her slavery, and he said there was no intercourse because he was trying to keep his promise to Janice. In Cameron's story, him and Colleen had agreed on a time to set Colleen free, but Colleen came in one day and asked if her current freedom would continue if she stayed. Cameron said yes, and Colleen agreed to stay. Cameron opened his arms and said, "Welcome to the family."
Oh my God.
Cameron said Colleen didn't want to get back into drugs, and he had promised she could have a baby. Now, Janice wanted Colleen to leave, but Cameron had fallen deeply in love with Colleen at this point. And over the next few months, Janice treated Colleen basically shitty because she was jealous and was trying to get her to leave.
What a great scapegoat Janice is for Cameron, right? Like, oh, yeah, it was Janice's idea.
Yeah,
right.
She has immunity, so he could literally push it all onto her and it wouldn't matter.
Yeah. Not that he would care anyway.
No, he wouldn't. He's a piece of shit. Janice would be the one to punish Colleen, and it was only rarely Cameron who did the punishing, and it was at Janice's request to appease her. Cameron said one day he'd hung Colleen up and left to go find something. When he returned, Janice had taped electrical wires onto Colleen. Cameron pulled the plug, he said, but both women yelled at him for interfering. And Cameron said after that, he stayed out of it.
I am, okay, the more this goes on, it's almost now he's leaned too much into this. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that the jury's like, wait just a fucking second.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm not thinking this is reasonable. I hope.
I hope as well. Cameron said Janice worked various jobs and would go out drinking after work, looking for men. Colleen would take care of the children all day and night. Cameron was only bothered by Janice's behavior in the beginning. He was in love with Colleen. So if Janice was out dating other men and going to parties, maybe she would find a new man. Cameron said at this point, him and Colleen were having sex and were doing light bondage consensually on a regular basis. They were discussing a baby and the possibility of marriage. Cameron said the slave collar kind of became a wedding band, and then they worked out the labia piercing, which he said was fairly common among BDSM fans.
That whole part, he probably did think in his mind, all of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Cameron testified that Colleen would meet him at the door with makeup on and hug him. She would sit on the floor with her hands on his knees and look up at him, which Cameron said was her way of asking for sex. Cameron said Colleen still believed he was in the company, but they didn't talk about it unless she asked because Cameron was afraid to lose her, and he knew that she looked up to powerful people.
Oh my God.
Cameron testified that about a month before the trip to see Colleen's family, Janice heard one of the girls call Colleen mommy, and she lost her mind. She quit her job, stopped dating other men, and that's when Cameron told Colleen it might be best if she left. Colleen agreed, and she went around to say goodbye to the neighbors, then spent the week in the box out of sight of the kids. Cameron denied ever having to do a shotgun obedience test or, you know, talking about the company with her before going to see her family. He said the original plan was for Colleen to go home for good, and they would just spend one last night together while they were there. But on the way down, they had a change of heart and decided Colleen would come home anyways.
This is, I'm so mad at him.
I know.
To say the least.
I know. I told you that I had to tell his story.
I know,
though,
and I wasn't sure where I didn't.
Bullshit.
Yeah. It's almost more infuriating because it's so not close, obviously, to the truth, but it just like circles it and like flies by the truth, and it's just
because of the BDSM thing.
Yes.
It's so like he's basically being like, no, I that's exactly what I did to her.
Yeah.
But she wanted it.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Cameron dropped her off with her family, as Colleen had said, and he called her the next night about 9 p.m. He said Colleen said she was ready to go. He came in, met her family. He said he was introduced as Mike because he said one mother-in-law was enough and he didn't want another one dropping in on him. Cameron told Colleen things would likely be rough with Janice, who was upset and didn't want Colleen around the kids anymore. Colleen considered it, told Cameron she loved him and that she could handle Janice, and they went home together. They had sex on the floor, and then Cameron put her in the box, where she stayed for the next 3 years at Janice's insistence to keep her away from the kids.
Cameron, the jury has to be thinking this is insane at this point.
I know. Cameron said there was no sex and almost no bondage during that time because Colleen wasn't free and it just wasn't the same. Why would anybody...
No.
Who would love a man, even if you did believe that she fell in love with him, who would be like, oh yes, she wants to be around him so much that she would live in that box for 3 years?
Exactly. He has made this so unreasonable that it's now equally unreasonable to the truth, except you have the truth backed up by Colleen and Janice. And you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
So had he just kept it more in the reasonable range, you actually probably could have gotten away with it. But because he's so off in the deep end,
and
now
he's
it's just as ridiculous.
And he's admitting that she was in the box for 3 years.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, he's admitting to everything that's happened.
Yeah.
Cameron said in 1984 that Colleen gave him an ultimatum that things had to change or she was going to leave. Janice agreed at that time that Colleen could be near the girls, and she was let out again. That's when Colleen and Janice were going to church together, and Cameron said they were getting along better than ever. Colleen got a job, and Cameron said the hooker's money was tight, so Colleen's checks went into a general fund that was used to pay bills. Colleen was allowed to keep $20 from each paycheck, which Cameron said was about what he and Janice got too. Roland asked Cameron if he intended to get more slaves, as the girls had said, and Cameron said he threatened it once, but he never intended to do it. Cameron was asked about the day that Colleen and Janice left. He said that they had asked to have that night to themselves and slept together on the floor. To Cameron's surprise, he got the call from Colleen from the bus station the next day. She told Cameron she knew he lied about the company and that it was time for her to leave and go home. Cameron said he cried and told her he loved her because goodbyes are hard. He said Colleen called him at midnight a day and a half later and said she missed him. She told him to get back with Janice for the kid's sake. 5 or 6 days later, Janice returned home. Also, why would she tell him that she's leaving because he lied about the company if he bought her out of the contract and she stayed consensually? Anyways,
none of it.
Overall, Cameron's testimony was that him, Colleen, and Janice were involved in a bizarre love triangle involving consensual slavery and bondage. Cameron said Colleen was in love with him, liked being a slave, and was told that she could leave. He said that Colleen was grateful to get off drugs and have a home because she wanted to be a mother. In addition to Cameron, the defense also called witnesses to testify who had met Colleen during this time, mostly relatives. They testified that she never showed any distress, that she was outgoing and happy. No one remembered any bruises or marks on her. Janice's mother testified that Kay never appeared to be a servant. One night she was at the Hookers for dinner and Kay didn't even help with the dishes. And shortly before Cameron's arrest, Janice told her parents that she knew for a fact Kay wasn't raped.
By the way, that's such a mother-in-law thing to say. Oh, she didn't even help with the dishes. Like, of course, that's what really, you're going
to
pick up on.
It really is a mother-in-law thing to say. Another witness testified that he visited the Hooker trailer every weekend in 1978 and saw Colleen every time. The witness was divorced in 1980 and spent 30 to 40 hours a week at the trailer. And he said that Colleen was always smiling and easygoing and that the girls called her mommy.
Who is this person?
I don't know. Some dude who just hung around the Hooker trailer all the time.
Yeah.
His job was to hang around the Hooker trailer. Exactly. Full-time job. A total of 11 witnesses would testify over 5 days for the defense, with the final witness being Dr. Donald T. Lund.
Right.
Dr. Lund was a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at Stanford Medical School, where he taught psychiatry and engaged in clinical work. He also had a private practice, specialized in forensic psychiatry, and had authored 40 articles and 8 books on the matter.
I feel like I'm having the stepbrother's reaction. Like, is he even a doctor? John, he went to Johns Hopkins. Is that good enough for you?
Qualified. I mean, he was qualified. He just was. Like Dr. Hatcher, Dr. Lund was asked to define the term coercion. He said it was a psychological phenomenon that occurs when someone has been threatened with death. He noted the threat had to be to the person themselves, not to others like family members. He said in the field of forensic psychiatry, the law simply does not allow for threats to other people. The judge interjected that the doctor couldn't define the law, and defense counsel tried again, getting Dr. Lund's testimony, but again, he went into legal definitions. Mm. The prosecutor moved for his definitions of coercion to be stricken from the record, which the judge granted.
Interesting. What made it defining the law?
When he's saying that the law doesn't allow for threats to other people, like he can't tell the jury what the law is.
Fascinating.
He can only testify as to psychiatry, and he kept indicating that the law doesn't allow it, or, you know, he was making it a legal definition.
If I were that lawyer, I'd be like, can you shut the fuck up, please?
Well, he kept trying to ask him different ways to get it out, and he just couldn't.
I would be so mad if that were my witness. I'd be like, no.
Brah.
Yeah, exactly. Brah,
cut it out. Dr. Lund was asked to define coercive persuasion, which Dr. Hatcher had said had no accepted definition in the field of psychology. In psychiatry, Dr. Lund said it meant a condition where a person does things they would not otherwise do, which are in fact possibly contrary to their own beliefs because of a situation of total captivity and control over their environment, and to a great extent, control over their behavior on a 24-hour-a-day basis.
Isn't this helping the state?
No, because I think they're going with the fact that she was allowed out.
Oh,
like they need the total control, basically.
I gotcha.
But then he again ventured into legal definitions and the prosecution objected again.
Oh my God, buddy.
Defense asked a hypothetical basically about Colleen's first year of captivity, and Dr. Lund agreed that would constitute coercive persuasion.
You fucking think.
Yep.
Yep.
The defense then attempted to outline the next 3 years of captivity, but after every effort, Christine objected for the hypothetical being incomplete, and the objections were all sustained.
Oh my God.
It happened so much that defense counsel just gave up.
Damn. Good for her.
Dr. Lund then testified generally that you need continuous physical captivity for coercive persuasion. So either caged or at gunpoint. Dr. Lund opined that anyone in a box for 23 hours a day would have noticeable muscular and bone damage from the lack of movement. And he also noted that they could suffer speech impediments from not speaking for that long. The court had a lunch break. And after that lunch break, the defense came back fresh and finally framed his hypothetical in a way that got the prosecution's objection overruled. But the judge did so begrudgingly. Dr. Lund testified that where there is no captivity, there is no coercive persuasion. And it goes against human nature for a person of average intelligence to stay in a situation they don't want to be in when they're free to go running or visit their family unsupervised.
That makes me mad because it's like a half truth.
I know.
Like, yeah, I am fine. I wouldn't be coerced sitting here of my own free will, but
right.
In that, there's so much more to that situation that yeah, that
prove
statement,
it. Right. You go do it.
Yeah.
And see what you do.
Oh,
I know. Ugh. I know. During cross-examination, the prosecution elicited testimony that physical labor and time out from the box could prevent the physical decline Dr. Lund insinuated should be present. And concerning the company, Dr. Lund testified that no reasonable person would believe in the company and that Colleen only stayed because she fell in love with Cameron Hooker.
Oh, that's so frustrating.
It's yucky.
Yeah.
Once counsel was finished, so many C's. So many C's. Oh, that's the count.
The count. I got you.
I was going with the letter of the day.
Also a C.
Clap, clap. It's the letter of the day.
Do you have kids?
I do. I have toddlers, if you didn't know.
Okay, just to guess.
Once counsel was finished, the judge jumped in to ask some clarifying questions. In discussing the trip to Riverside, the doctor testified that he's had victims subjected to worse torture than Colleen, who jumped at the chance to escape and call the police. But the judge elicited that their families hadn't been threatened in those situations.
Oh.
And Dr. Lund all but conceded that sacrificing oneself for the safety of their loved ones could be a form of selfless love.
You think? Yeah. Mm.
The defense rested and the state called one rebuttal witness and Elaine Corning, who knew Cameron when he was 16 and who testified that Cameron told her he wished he had a dungeon under his parents' house to keep women.
Uh-huh. Doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. And that was it.
Mic drop. Yeah.
Yeah. The evidence was done.
Wow.
After the evidence closed, but before closing arguments, the court heard motions from the parties. The two charges of abducting to live in an illicit relationship were both dropped as the judge agreed with defense counsel that in 1985, it was impossible to define an illicit relationship with a statute from 1905.
Yeah, that's
which
fair.
Everyone keep in mind. I love the meme that's like, maybe we shouldn't know exactly what the founding fathers were thinking when these are people where the existence of a dishwasher would blow their mind.
Yes, exactly.
Things change.
Yeah, anyways, a little bit.
Things change. 11 felony counts remained and 5 had to be amended. The statute under which Cameron was charged with sexual assault changed in 1981.
Oh.
So basically in the middle of this. So the charges had to be edited accordingly and the jury would have to be instructed differently for sexual assaults occurring in different years.
Oh my God.
Not confusing at all for a layperson who's trying to get these jury instructions.
Holy shit.
Then came closing arguments. The two parties reviewed the evidence before the jury. I'll just hit two high points. I think it's two high points. The defense pointed out that Janice went to the police in 1984 when Colleen was threatening to return to Red Bluff and Janice was worried it would start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
The defense said that Colleen only claimed she was held against her will out of embarrassment. He said it was better for her to say that she was a slave than that she was kidnapped and fell in love with her kidnapper.
Creative.
Yep.
Colleen
was just jealous that Cameron never kicked Janice out, and now she stood to gain from claiming she was a slave by filing a civil lawsuit and was considering selling her rights to the story.
Oh.
And as the party with the burden of proof, the state had the final say. And one key point was that the statute of limitations precluded Christine from charging Cameron with sexual assault crimes occurring after the statute expired. And wasn't it strange how Cameron admitted to sex crimes occurring before the statute expired,
yes,
but
girl.
None thereafter?
Yes. Yep. Call him out.
How convenient.
Yep.
He's like, no, no, no. It totally was kidnappy and rapey in the beginning.
Until 1981.
But then she fell in love with me like right before the statute expired, and everything after that was consensual. Yep. For sure. And with that, the jury had the case. Oof. On day one, the jury asked for the definition of duress and menace. On the second day, the attorneys thought a verdict was in because the judge had everyone assemble, but really he just needed to make a slight change to the jury instructions. Ugh. But on his way out of the courtroom, Cameron smiled at the bailiff and said, "I know I'm going home tomorrow."
Oh, that shit.
That smug fucker.
I hate him.
And some thought Cameron might be right.
Yeah.
The media and public discussed the case in the hallways as they waited. The women thought Cameron was guilty, but the men felt that he was innocent and that Colleen had fallen in love.
Fascinating.
On day three, the jurors sent in a note and asked how the jury was to decide if they were hung on one or two counts. The judge explained that each count was separate, so the jury could be hung on just that count.
Oh.
That afternoon, they had a verdict, but they were hung on one count, 6-6.
Oh,
even split.
Gosh.
They're like, that one's done. They were brought in and the verdict read, Cameron was guilty on 10 felony counts.
Hell yeah.
The jury was hung on the rape charge in 1984. Six people felt it wasn't rape since Colleen had asked Janice first if it was okay. The whole trial lasted 6 weeks and the court agreed with the verdict. Judge Knight said, "I would like to say that I know what a terrible emotional strain it must have been for all of you to go through this. Looking back on it, you can say that in a way it's a happy ending because faith and love, and I mean Colleen Stan's faith in God and her love of her family did triumph over evil. You have done justice, and I certainly agree with your verdict."
Holy moly.
Some of the jurors were asked about the trial. One juror said it was Colleen's deadness and stillness that made her compelling. I have chills.
Yes.
I have chills thinking about.
My leg hair has grown so much in this episode.
Just thinking about her like deadpan talking about this.
Her deadpan affect. I'll just fill you all in since you've plugged along for this long. I'll just tell you that we spent quite a while in the beginning of this episode determining the correct pronunciation of affect and then
being wholly unable to pronounce it correctly
without laughing either. Yes. So that's why I had to mention that part.
Thank you. Another juror said that Dr. Lund's testimony tied it all together for them, which is funny because he was the defense expert. Right,
exactly.
Because they said even if Colleen was in love, it was the love of an abused child seeking affection after abuse.
Bingo.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yes.
Attorney McGuire was the one to call Colleen and tell her the news, and Colleen said, "Praise the Lord, justice is done."
Oh,
Cameron. Colleen. Cameron was sentenced on November 22nd, 1985. A written statement prepared by Colleen was read into the record in which Colleen pleaded with the court to sentence Cameron to the maximum possible sentence.
Uh-huh.
And Judge Knight delivered.
Yes.
He said, and I quote, "I consider this defendant the most dangerous psychopath that I've ever dealt with in that he is the opposite of what he seems. He will be a danger to women as long as he is alive, and I intend to sentence the maximum possible."
Yes.
Cameron was sentenced to consecutive sentences for his sex crimes totaling 69 years. He was sentenced to indeterminate sentences of 1 to 25 years for kidnap plus 5 to 10 years for use of a knife. So Cameron would serve a total of 104 years if he was perpetually denied parole.
Okay.
The judge also fined him $50,000. He was like, and also fuck you.
Yes. Yes.
At the end of the sentencing hearing, in true asshole fashion, Cameron told his attorney, "I want you to thank the judge for me. I have a library, a gym, and time to enjoy them, and it's better than living with those two women."
What the fuck?
He sucks.
What?
I know. You just hate him. Yeah, just hate him. 3 days after Cameron's conviction, he called Colleen from jail.
Are you kidding me?
No. Listen, as someone with DOC connections, that would not happen in Connecticut.
I would hope not.
No. He told her she could say whatever she wanted to him, but she said she had nothing to say and hung up.
Good. Yes.
She told the prosecutor, and the prosecutor made sure the jail wouldn't let Cameron call ever again.
Good.
2 months after Cameron was sentenced, Janice filed for divorce. I feel like I'm doing like a where are they now update.
Yeah.
She was able to keep custody of the girls because it was clear that the girls had been shielded from all of these activities.
Thank God.
After the criminal case, Colleen did receive some financial compensation, although it would never be enough.
No, of course not.
She received $20,000 from the California Victim Witness Program, and the home insurance on the Hooker's mobile home settled a civil case for $150,000.
Gotta love those insurance companies.
You know, and it's not fraud, so
no.
It's good to go.
No, that's why it took 7 years.
Colleen has done her best to move on with her life, but she'll be forever changed.
Oh, yeah.
Due to malnutrition and a lack of hygiene, she has dental issues and thin hair. She has chronic shoulder and back problems and lasting psychological issues.
Yeah, fuck that doctor who said, oh, she would have an issue. She does.
Yeah, no, she's got some issues.
Yeah.
She's afraid to go out alone and doesn't like crowds. She doesn't like to go out to eat because she still feels compelled to eat everything on her plate from when she never knew when she was getting food again.
Oh, my God.
She suffers from PTSD and struggles to hold down a job or maintain relationships.
I would absolutely think so.
Mm-hmm. But it's not all bad. In April 1987, Colleen gave birth to a baby girl, and she said she had always dreamed of being a mother.
Oh, I'm so, so happy for her.
I know.
Oh, my God. Because we always talk about murder is one thing, and it's obviously terrible, and nobody should be murdering anyone. But something like this, you're still, he murdered who she was.
Right,
and
exactly.
Who she could have been.
Yes.
So yep.
Yes. And we talked about the informative years of your life.
Yeah.
I mean, from 20 to 27 ish.
The what years?
No. In the formative. The those, formative years.
I those, said. You said informative.
Did I?
You sure did.
Well, they are both.
They are both informing and forming.
And informative.
The schnozberries taste like schnozberries.
Okay. We're almost there. Cameron appealed his conviction because, of course, why wouldn't he? It was denied.
Good.
And it came out that he had apparently said in jail that his biggest mistake was not killing Colleen when he had the chance. So
I think he fully believes that.
Rotten hell, sir.
Yeah.
At the time of his sentencing, the amount of time that Cameron would actually serve in prison was left uncertain, mm-hmm. as he had those terms of indeterminate sentencing from 6 to 35 years.
Yep.
So if he was denied parole, he would serve 104. Cameron's last parole hearing was in 2015. He was denied for another 15 years and wasn't eligible until 2030.
Okay.
He requested to advance that date, but that was also denied.
Good.
In 2019, the district attorney, the Red Bluff police chief, Corning police chief, and former Tehama County sheriff all wrote letters to the Department of Corrections requesting that Cameron be evaluated as a sexually violent offender.
I'll say.
In California, there's a statute that permits the state to civilly commit an offender after their prison sentence if the individual has a history of sexual offenses and he's found to be suffering from a mental disorder that makes it likely that he will engage in sexually violent criminal behavior when released unless that person is committed to a mental health facility.
Check.
Before being released.
I would say yes, that's Cameron.
Yes. The district attorney said that the Department of Corrections agreed to evaluate him, and the DA wrote another letter in August 2020 reminding DOC of their obligation to evaluate them.
Uh-huh.
The DA's actions proved critical. Due to changes in state law to the good conduct credit available to inmates, Cameron became eligible and was released on parole to the Department of State Hospitals in 2021.
Oh my God. Also, by the way, how old is he approximately in all of this? Like, how old was he when he kidnapped Colleen?
So he was born in 53. And what did I say? She was kidnapped in 76.
No way.
By the way, I have like three packets I have a pile of papers here with my
notes. Refer to number page, literally.
Part one.
Wait a second. That would put him at 23? When he kidnapped Colleen?
Well, he's still alive, so yes.
Holy shit.
Yeah, well, they were like young. Remember he like...
Do you know it's because I combined him with Toy Box Killer?
Oh.
And so in my head, yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah, this was... So he... Yeah, after he graduated high school, he got the job at the lumber mill.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he met Janice, and then they got married.
Skipped all that in my brain and made him like,
and they were like 21. No,
holy shit, that's insane that he was so he thank God he was that Janice ended up going to the police.
Yeah,
he had a whole lifetime of this ahead of him
for sure.
Okay, so now granted, where as much as in my head the 80s are only like 15 or 20 years ago. I realized that's many more. So he is older now. However, mm-hmm. being released that early in, what did you say, 21, mm-hmm. makes him still pretty young. Well,
he's in his 70s.
Still capable, still a concern to society had they not.
He's breathing.
Right. Right.
It's a problem.
It's not a Fritzl situation. I know I keep trying to compare it, but like, yes. It's not the same thing as that.
So, oh, yeah. No, he has like bad, bad dementia. Exactly.
So now we're coming full circle to thank goodness that they had put through all of this and had the foresight for that, mm-hmm. despite it seeming like he would have been in jail the rest of his life.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Wow. My mind is blown that he was that young.
Well, I mean, he had to be pretty like young and fit too for all the things that he was doing and building and constructing.
Wow. Okay. Sorry. That really, really blew my mind.
Please continue. Sorry I didn't just point it out. I did go through the timeline initially, but I guess.
You have given quite a bit of information.
There's like what, like 30? Like 30 pages of information just on the table.
Yeah.
At this point, Cameron has been evaluated at the state hospital and has been deemed positive for a classification as a sexually violent predator. Although it has been delayed several times, Cameron's hearing is currently scheduled for March 9th, 2024, and is expected to last 2 weeks. So at the time of our recording, it's just a few weeks away. I think it'll be like days away when this comes out. But I have a feeling that he will easily be classified. And if anyone would classify as a sexually violent offender, it is this fucking guy.
Wow.
So that is it. So thank you, Gremlins, for hanging in on this one. You're either going to think all this detail was very interesting, which if you're still listening to us, then you totally did.
Yep. I figure I do. And you guys we all have similar interests, however depraved those may be. We all do. And if you didn't, you know, you'd look at this and say, Marina's legal corner for an hour and a half. I will just wait till the next episode.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a win-win.
Yeah.
It's a win-win. But no, in all seriousness, every time you've done a case, I'll give you accolades because I love how you do cases. But seriously, like, this was so good. I'm so glad you did an entire episode on this because as much as I had to hear the details regardless, but to have you take us through it, I don't think you realize, like, because I obviously also do cases and I will also talk through a trial. I feel like I'm fumbling through the whole time. It's so hard for me to pull it all together and explain things. And I think your ability to walk us through it and like bring it to life is just so good. It's so good. I mean, it's a terrible case and fuck Cameron.
Yes.
But so well done.
Thank you. Because I always feel like when I speak legal and you ask me one of the most basic questions, it's like when my child will be like, what is existing? And I'm like, oh, fuck, I don't know how to put that into words. Like, I feel like it's like things that I know, but like,
yes,
I don't have to verbalize them often. So my brain is like, you're shutting down.
I remember we went to school with a lot of people becoming teachers and a lot of them elementary school teachers. And I remember I minored in math. And so I was in class with these people and they were like, one of the hardest things to teach is actually basic addition.
Yeah.
Because it's literally the concept of what like zero is and what one is. And
right.
Like, I can't explain. Can I explain multiplication and I can explain further things? Yes. But the actual, like, how do you explain nothing versus one, you know? So that always stuck with me.
Yeah. It's like explaining the most basic principles can be harder than explaining something incredibly complex. And also, I haven't practiced criminal law for a while. So
well, you could have fooled me.
When you catch me off guard, I'm like, I don't know.
But what about when I cash you outside?
How about that? I didn't miss it. Yay. Yay me. So if you're enjoying listening to this unhinged episode of Grimm, please rate and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts to make sure you don't miss any episodes. If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, we'd be forever grateful if you took a minute to leave us a written review because we love them and we make our day. They make our day.
And if we also make our day because we're confident queens.
And if we make your day, make our day. Follow us on Instagram at Grimm Crime Podcast for information on future episodes and case photos. If you want to send us a case suggestion or just say hi, you can email us at grimmcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget we have bonus episodes on Patreon. Yes. If you want to become a Patreon, you can subscribe to that at patreon.com and Google. No, and Patreon search Grimm colon True Crime Podcast.
It's going down. This is getting bad, guys. Get out. Jump ship.
Listen, learn, and stay alive until next time, because the future is grim.